we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 72, recorded July 29th, 2011. May the Swartz be with you. Well, welcome back to Digital Campus. I think it's episode 72. I'm Tom Scheinfeld at foundhistory.org. Here today with a couple of the regulars, Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Tom.
And Dan is not with us this week. Dan is enjoying some much-needed time away from email and podcasting to get some writing done in the lovely Berkshires, not too far from where I am here in Connecticut. Also joining us this week, definitely taking the place and filling Dan's shoes, here is Lisa Spiro. Lisa, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Hey, Dan. Tom.
It's good to have you. It's good to have you back. It's been a while. People do that all the time.
I was thinking, Dan. And,
yeah. It happens all the time. It's good to have you back. I hear that you're in a new gig.
I do have a new gig. I am the director of Knightley Labs now.
Great. And how is that? You've been in that for a couple of months now.
It's about 3 months now.
And it's going well.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
I've got great colleagues and interesting work, so I couldn't ask for much more.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about what Knightley Labs is and what it's doing?
Knightley Labs is working with liberal arts colleges that are part of the Knightley Network. And Knightley is the National Institute for Technology in Liberal Education. And one of the things we are working on is facilitating collaborative experiments that will allow liberal arts colleges to explore innovative technologies and models to improve liberal arts education.
Great, great. Sounds like a really interesting work, and sounds like you're going to get a chance to work with a lot of very cool people around the country. So congrats.
Indeed. Thank you.
Jeff McClurkin's also joining us, another one of our irregulars, our long-lost irregulars. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. How's your summer going?
Been very busy.
Yeah. Lots of committee work and other things, I'm guessing?
Well, we're moving back into newly renovated spaces, so that's been both wonderful and traumatic.
So. I'm sure. Space is always a tough issue. Well, let's take a look at what we've got on the roster here today. The first thing, I think we can't avoid it, the big story of the past couple weeks in our circles, I think, has been the Swartz story. This was the hacking of MIT's JSTOR repository, their JSTOR access, their JSTOR server, I guess, by a Harvard researcher named Aaron Swartz, who is a sort of a well-known hacktivist who has done I'm not trying to make a judgment here. We'll talk about the merits or demerits of this later. But he's done a number of these actions over the years to liberate data. So this was made the New York Times caught the attention of the feds who have indicted him for these actions. I think I'll toss it over to Amanda. I think you've been following this. What do you make of all this? What do you see as the merits and demerits of Swartz's actions here?
Oh gosh, don't get me started. We were when this broke on Tuesday, July 19th. We were all kind of sitting around the CHNM table, and I I have to say, I didn't get much else done that day just from following this story. So if you were tracking my productivity that day, you probably would not have have been impressed. But so the narrative of the story is kind of interesting, at least in terms of, you know, I'm going to tell my reactions to the story. So first, basically, that I saw some headlines roll by in Twitter along the lines of internet activists charged in data theft, Reddit co-founder charged in data theft. And it turns out he really isn't a Reddit co-founder. And I was like, well, you know, I don't really care. And then internet activists charged, you know, indicted for downloading too many articles. Now, that was something I was going to click on. And I clicked on that, and I was appalled at first. I thought, oh, my gosh, they've indicted this guy. He could potentially, you know, pay, you know, spend 35 years in prison, pay $1 million or more in fines. And I thought that was outrageous. And then I went and read the indictment and realized that what they were charging him for was really hacking into MIT's network. Not so, I mean, yes, the downloading of articles, but that wasn't exactly what he's indicted for. It was really, you know, the actions that he took to get into MIT's network, where he was not affiliated at all, in order to download almost 5 million articles in PDF form from JSTOR. And at that point, my outrage started to ebb quite a bit, because number one, JSTOR has never been the worst offender when it comes to enclosing our intellectual commons. In fact, JSTOR is, you know, one of the most beloved database projects, journal e-publishing projects. They're a nonprofit organization. They're really run kind of by librarians and scholars for librarians and scholars. Yes, you do have to pay for access to JSTOR. It's about $50,000 a year, but that's very little compared to a lot of other databases or journals. And what they provide is so great, and they have such a great interface to it, that I think most people find that those costs are really justified, and they don't go around jacking up the price a whole bunch either. And he's not charged with any intellectual property theft at all. He's not charged with copyright infringement. He's not charged with you know, the equivalent of piracy. What he's charged with is hacking into MIT's network. Now, for the purpose of committing fraud, because at first I thought, well, maybe he's doing this. I assumed that he was doing this for the purpose of conducting some kind of analysis, some kind of digging into data analysis on all these articles. Because I was thinking about the guy who was doing that with Facebook data. There was a researcher whose name I've forgotten who downloaded a bunch of data from Facebook because he wanted to analyze it, and that broke Facebook's terms of service, and he got in trouble with Facebook, but he didn't get indicted. And so I was ready to be appalled. And then looking into it more, it became clear that no, Swartz really is a radical open access activist, and probably was planning to post nearly, you know, these 5 million PDFs online. And, you know, he hadn't done that yet. And, you know, if he had done so, then, you know, maybe they would have charged him with other things. But at the moment, what he's being charged with is hacking into MIT's network. I'll wind up here. Here's the thing. I don't think that he should spend 35 years in prison and pay $1 million for doing this. I do think that what he did was illegal and should have been illegal. I think the feds are probably going after him a little harder than, in fact, I know that they're going after him harder than either MIT or JSTOR wants. Both institutions said, you know, we're okay with it. We don't need him to be charged with these crimes. But it was, you know, the federal government who decided that he's kind of a dangerous computer hacker and, you know, needs to be indicted and taught a lesson. I'm not a fan of Aaron Swartz's. I think that what he did was stupid and possibly hideously counterproductive for the open access movement. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, I have sort of mixed feelings about this as well. I think I come down in the end about where you do, Amanda. Mills, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, actually, I have a question for Amanda. What if instead, since he was a Harvard researcher, he had set up a whole network of downloaders, you know, like-minded people at Harvard, and each of them had decided to download through the normal Harvard interface every single article from a particular journal, then there wouldn't have been any hacking. So what if he had then posted it all online?
See, I kind of think...
Then you get into the copyright issue.
Right. I kind of think that would have been a little awesome. Probably still... Probably still kind of wrong. So everybody should know that there was, in fact, somebody rallied to Aaron Swartz's support, a guy named Gregory Maxwell, who is a sort of a hobbyist scientist here in D.C., a technologist and programmer. He posted a BitTorrent on Pirate Bay, kind of in sympathy, of all the public domain articles from the Royal Transactions of the Philosophical Society, all the pre-1923 ones, so all the public domain ones. And he was doing it with, you know, the notion that, you know, these are public domain. You shouldn't have to charge, you know, you shouldn't have to pay for access to these articles. And I do agree with that. I mean, I even think that that's a tiny, there are issues with that, which is that JSTOR has spent a great deal of money. One estimate that I saw says about at least a dollar per page to digitize and make these things available. And so, yes, they're kind of losing that investment when you take that kind of thing. But it's, you know, whether posting public domain stuff online is illegal is just simply hasn't been determined. Now, in the scenario that you described, Mills, what I would have liked about that would have been if it were public and everybody had owned up to it. If everybody had said, as Gregory Maxwell did, we think that this is our nation's scientific record, scholarly record, and we think that as a matter of principle, it should be made available online for free. I think there's, you know, there's some justice behind that. And as a public act of civil disobedience, you know, that would have fit much better with something like, you know, that Martin Luther King would have done, where you walk right in and you sit down at that, you know, counter and you say, I'm going to disobey your unjust law, and here I am, and come put me in prison. That's not what Aaron Swartz was doing. He was attempting to hide his presence on the MIT network, like, multiple times. So
yeah, and that's the reason I asked the question, because for me, it's sort of two issues. One of them is, you know, there's a legal issue. I mean, he broke into a computer system, which he apparently broke into a computer system for which he did not have access. And, you know, the Times story said he had, you know, a bicycle helmet over his face, and he was down in a, you know, an access room, and you know, was crashing the MIT servers and that sort of thing. So that's, you know, the method is clearly very problematic. The bigger question, though, I think, is one that we're going to continue to debate, and that's the degree to which information is a public good or a private good. And I'm entirely sympathetic to the fact that it costs a lot of money to digitize all this stuff, and And so at some point, those costs have to be recovered through subscriptions and that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. You know, JSTOR would not have digitized all of this material had there not been some way of recovering their costs on that. And nor would, you know, government agencies pay for that kind of, you know, digitization, especially of increasingly out-of-the-way journals as opposed to the, you know, sort of the main and the big and prestigious journals. But it seems to me that there's also some kind of a lifetime on that. That cost recovery that is going to be interesting to see where that goes. And I'll give you a very specific example. When I was young, back a long, long time ago, when you drove through Richmond, Virginia on Interstate 95, there were a whole series of toll booths, and which made for just an unbelievable traffic snarl. And those toll booths were there to pay for the construction of the interstate going through downtown Richmond. And then miraculously one day, they were gone. And the reason they were gone was because the cost of the construction of the interstate had been recovered through the toll process. And miraculously, the U.S. Department of Transportation said, we're done. We've recovered the cost. And so now the use of that interstate highway is a public access, a public good, and everybody's paid for it. So we don't have to keep paying for it. They probably now, given the budget negotiations, wish that they still had those toll booths. But, but you know, I think I would be interested to know, and I don't know the answer to this question, whether, you know, JSTOR will continue to charge $50,000 a year in perpetuity for subscriptions, or once the cost of digitization has been recovered, will the cost drop substantially so that, you know, larger public library systems and others who don't have, can't currently drop $50,000 on a subscription to something like this will, and small private colleges which can't afford JSTOR access.
You know, it's interesting, Mills. I think kudos to the state of Virginia. Because I know in the state of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority, that was supposed to happen there as well with the tolls on the Mass Pike. And those costs were recovered decades ago. And the toll booths and the people manning the toll booths are all still there, and they're not going anywhere because the state became reliant on that revenue. And you know, institutions, big ones, JSTOR is now a fairly large institution, are built on these things, and
they become about perpetuating their existence.
Yeah, it's tough to take down those tolls once they're up. I mean, people's jobs depend on them, and you know, there's guys who've made a career sitting in that toll booth. What are you going to do? Put them out of work. So it's an issue.
This was always why I have been hugely in favor of the Digital Public Library of America. Because I feel that that's a place where at least the public domain materials in JSTOR could be stored and made available to everybody. Granted, the public domain materials are probably among the least useful of the stuff that JSTOR has. And I will say, Mills, too, that unlike the bridges, JSTOR keeps adding content and they keep adding services. So there's at least some justification for continuing to have it. Like, just for instance, they recently had they've launched a service to provide current journals. They always had a moving wall type of thing where you couldn't access most journals, you know, like the most recent issues of most journals, and that was to, you know, protect publishers' stream of income. But now they've sort of made deals with those publishers to where you can get the very most recent issue of those journals and things like that. They add new titles, they add new interfaces, they add new services all the time. So
yeah, and I totally get that. My issue, and I think this is kind of similar to yours, Amanda, is that at some point information becomes a public good. And so when does that happen?
I guess I'll just say one last word before throwing it over to Lisa and Jeff, who I think have an interesting perspective on this, coming from or working with smaller institutions. One thing I think that I think gets lost in this story, you know, when we're looking at it from the point of view of humanities scholars, And in fact, looking at it as hacking of JSTOR, in the end, JSTOR is actually small potatoes. And I think what the feds are looking at are the big potatoes. And what I mean by that is, okay, it's one thing to hack into MIT's network and post a bunch of old issues of, like, you know, the Journal of American History on the BitTorrents. Like, there's not really, what's the harm, right? There's a lot of stuff on MIT's network that could cause a lot of harm. My wife is an export controls attorney, and there's, you know, MIT has huge defense contracts, and I'm pretty sure that that's probably what the feds are looking at, that, you know, we can't have people hacking into MIT's systems, because I think there's a lot of really sensitive information that wouldn't be in the public interest. It wouldn't be a public good to have out there. Yeah, I mean, they're working on nuclear technology. They're working on all kinds of chemical technologies, systems, you know, that control drone aircrafts and, you know, aircraft and all of that kind of stuff. I think, you know, that's where I think the feds are probably, you know, they're setting an example with this guy who actually didn't do, you know, that kind of harm. But the next guy might. And so that's where I think the feds probably struck the right balance in not prosecuting him for copyright infringement, but prosecuting him for wire fraud. Because there is this issue of protecting this very sensitive material on, you know, major research universities' networks. But I think the issues are different for a lot of institutions. I think MIT's issues are probably very different from those at the University of Mary Washington and at the institutions that Knightley represents and serves. And that's where it comes to, you know, I think, Amanda, you mentioned $50,000 for a JSTOR subscription. I think that's probably on a sliding scale for smaller institutions. I bet there's some kind of discount for for you know smaller institutions. But those are huge costs, you know. And then as you said, the for-profit databases are even more expensive. And I think we've seen in the last couple. Over the last several months and even years, institutions, especially in this financial crunch, moving towards abandoning some of these big subscription packages. There was our irregular Jen Howard had a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education reporting on this trend of libraries abandoning these big package subscription deals for other avenues for providing data. Lisa, you suggested this story. What's the situation at these smaller institutions? How are they dealing with these skyrocketing subscription costs and the pressures that these gated resources put on their budgets and on their students and faculty?
Well, I know from personal experience, having moved from a larger institution to a much smaller one, that it is incredibly frustrating not to have the same degree of access to subscription databases that I once had. I feel like it really restricts my ability to do research. Some publishers have become somewhat infamous for the increasingly high prices they charge for access to databases and for sort of forcing libraries to agree to deals in which different journals are sort of bundled together, including ones that libraries and universities have no real need for. So for a while, I think libraries were sort of reluctantly going along with this because they felt like they would really anger faculty and students if they fought back too much and just started canceling subscriptions. But I think the tide is turning, especially as libraries really struggle with tight budgets. So, Jen Howard's article, for example, talked about how Oregon and Southern Illinois, among other universities, have decided to renegotiate their deals with publishers like Elsevier and Wiley. And instead of agreeing to these huge packages, which include journals that they have no real need for, they are presenting data, actual data, to these publishers saying, look, you know, on a cost per use basis, it just doesn't make sense for us to retain this journal. And they have had some success in renegotiating deals and saving their university's money. So I think that this is a trend that will continue.
Is this something that's happening that you're seeing, Jeff, at Mary Washington?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is. I've done a lot of work with the library here at Mary Washington, and the fact is that we just don't have the kind of acquisitions budget in our library that allows us to really subscribe to a lot of these databases. They're just way too much money. Forget the notion that we might actually still be buying books, but which you know we do. But when it becomes, when you look at a acquisitions budget that in many cases does not increase very much, if at all, over the last decade, and you have the cost of these databases going up at a minimum 5 to 6% a year, you begin to have to make some pretty tough choices. And and I think that beginning to go back at these companies, these publishing companies, and saying, look, you know, people are not using we're not using this incredibly wide array of options that you have. It doesn't make sense for us to purchase these things. I think that's one sort of piece of leverage. But schools the size of ours and others about our size, we have about 5,000 students, we just don't have the kind of leverage that some of these other institutions that even that are being talked about in the Chronicle article that you mentioned, we just don't have the kind of leverage to go and negotiate with these publishers in big ways. Now, one of the options is there are some possibilities within the state to work with other institutions and to try to get access on a group basis. And so that's one possibility and one way to try to gain some leverage. But even so, it seems to me those are stopgap measures for the most part. You know, one of the things I think that we may want to look at is buying these things piecemeal, or even paying per access. That may end up saving us a great deal more money. You know, I don't know. There's so many problems here, and I want to circle back briefly to the notion of infrastructure costs that Mills and Amanda were talking about. It seems in some ways, the infrastructure costs for digitization of these journals should be declining, not increasing, and yet they are increasing every year. I think that makes it harder and harder to justify. In some cases, people like JSTOR are adding functionality, which is great, but as journals go to an increasingly born digital format, some of these costs become harder and harder to justify. But yeah, at a small institution, this is a big deal. It's a big deal, and it further emphasizes the divide between the haves and the have-nots in the higher ed. And I think this is going to be a bigger problem, not a smaller problem, going forward.
Well, and it's interesting because a lot of the comments about this case, particularly on places like Ars Technica, which did report it and has a lot of people commenting who are not necessarily academics, a lot of the comments were, why can't an individual subscribe to JSTOR? Why can't, why do you have to pay on a per article basis? Because often it's, $7 or $12 per article, something like that. And that's, becomes untenable if you're doing any kind of serious research. I know that people have said they wish they could get alumni access. I've heard that about LexisNexis, right? That LexisNexis's strategy is to get law students hooked on LexisNexis. And then when they leave law school and go to their firms, the firms wind up needing to pay for LexisNexis because the students are so hooked on it. I think that would be great if UVA offered that kind of alumni access to some databases. That would be terrific. I know too that there's a lot of sharing that goes on between academics. I mean, there's a lot of essentially copyright infringement. It happens all the time. I mean, I will cop to absolutely infringing copyright. If somebody, a journalist or somebody at a small institution, post something on Twitter or emails me and says, I need a copy of such and such, but I can't get access to it, I'm going to email that person a copy of that PDF. And there are studies that librarians have done that show that this is widespread among faculty. Same thing with classes. It's related to the whole Georgia State e-reserves case. I'm going to put a copy of some article in Blackboard for my class if I think they need to read that. That's at least as widespread as peer-to-peer file sharing among teenagers, and it just shows that the distribution system is kind of broken. There's a lot of demand for this stuff where people would pay a reasonable price for it, but they're not going to pay the prices that are being asked.
And maybe that's why we don't see why those institutions in the article, the Chronicle article, haven't found faculty complaints, because when faculty run across an article that they need, there are ways around that system. Not that faculty necessarily want to be violating copyright, but they want to have access to the information they need, and if there's a pretty easy system to get it, and I think that's a problem in the long term for the publishers. They're not going to. I don't think they're going to go after individual faculty members for, not going to go after Amanda for emailing an article. That's not cost effective to them. But collectively, that becomes a problem for them. I hope that means that they'll think about, other ways to address these issues and address the needs that academics have.
It is such a warped. It's such a warped market. The market for these journal articles where the producers of the journal articles are, so many steps removed from the consumers of the journal articles. And there's sort of like, layers of middlemen who kind of just distort all of the pricing. Right. So you could imagine a system which connected, the kind of producers of the knowledge to the consumers of the knowledge in a much more efficient way. But that's not the system we have by any means.
And Swartz even kind of invokes that informal practice in his guerrilla open access manifesto, which I think explains and attempts to justify why he did what he did. I mean, he says that already academics will share articles with friends and colleagues. So and he's sort of making the claim that what he is doing is just a step beyond that in the tradition of civil disobedience. Now, what civil disobedience is in sort of an internet age is a larger question.
Well, I think this is something we're gonna continue to watch. Jeff, you mentioned libraries still occasionally buying a book here and there, despite these pressures. I think we saw this month one less place to buy those books. Borders is closed. I just drove by one here near my house and saw that there was I guess it was last weekend, and people were lined up outside at 9 a.m. for the big Everything Must Go sale. I think that all of the Borders that we've had in our neighborhoods are going to be gone. I think that leaves us basically, with the exception of a few independent bookstores here and there, with one major bookseller in the country, and that's Barnes & Noble. What do people think about the demise of you know, the Burger King to Barnes & Noble's McDonald's?
Well, you know, I mean, just to sort of a quick irony about all those people lining up is that even now, even in the supposed fire sale, the discounts at Borders are actually not as good as the discounts at Amazon, and so that's a sign of, right, of the problems that bricks and mortar store have for selling books, especially the books on what we think of as sort of the long tail, the books that academics write and sell, where you're talking about a few hundred people who want it nationally, as opposed to, you know, the latest Harry Potter. But you know, I think I'm somebody who really loved walking around Borders and spent a lot of time in Borders, but for years it seemed to me that they, I just couldn't see how they could succeed going forward. It seemed like the financial odds were against them. You know, in most cases, if you went into unless you were getting one of those bestsellers, the odds that they would actually have the book that you went in to get were not particularly high. And that was just the reality of having a physical space and trying to meet everyone's needs. So, I guess I sort of saw this coming a long time ago. It makes me sad in one sense, but I also, you know, I don't know that they had a business model that they could have pursued. So,
anyone else?
I'm not going to miss them.
You're not going to miss them.
I'm not going to miss them. I never loved the big bookstores like Barnes & Noble and Borders, and I don't see that there's a huge difference between them and Amazon. Amazon's a little more convenient to me because the boxes show up at my house. And those big bookstores largely killed off the mom-and-pop businesses, which I think we'll then begin to see, especially if Barnes & Noble goes the way of Borders, we'll see which won't surprise me, then, or that they'll just shift to an entirely online business, then I think we'll see a resurgence of some of these niche book retailers, which would be great because then you can go in and talk to people about the books and you know, and they'll sell certain kinds of things, you know, like Politics and Prose Bookstore here in Washington, which is a real institution. There's a lot you can't buy there, but you can, if you want things about politics or literature, that's a great place to go. So I think that's what we're going to see, and that's fine with me. I have no special love for these big bookstores. Also, I would say that that, you know, the secondary market, the resale market, is really thriving. Used bookstores, really quality used bookstores, are cropping up all over the place. So people still like to buy books. They may buy them for the first time online and then rebuy them or buy a used version at some quality used bookstore.
I mean, what's interesting about Borders and Barnes & Noble too, I guess, is that, you know, we look at them as these behemoths that killed the independent bookstore now. And that's certainly true. But if you kind of like, if you look back at like the 80s and let's say the early 90s, it seemed like the bookstore, the big innovation in the bookstore in those decades was the little bookstore moving into the mall, the kind of like Walden Books in the mall, you know, and those were even worse. And in some respects, Borders and Barnes & Noble were like a welcome, you know, so great. If you live in, you know, lower downtown in Denver, you've got Tattered Cover and that's wonderful. But like if you lived in, you know, Peoria, Illinois, your bookstore in 1985 was like the Walden Books in the mall.
B. Dalton.
Yeah, B. Dalton. Like when Borders and Barnes and if Borders and Barnes and Noble came to your town, all of a sudden for you that was like a huge improvement in the selection and even in the expertise of the staff. So I think in places like, you know, in places that, you know, aren't going to have the, you know, the hipster indie bookstore, you know, where there's just not a market to support that, and clearly there's not a market to support Borders either, but the death of these big box bookstores is, you know, is going to be kind of sad.
Well, now, how much do people think Borders' failed ebook strategy had to do with this bankruptcy? Because I think I actually follow the ebook, you know, stories pretty closely, and I really don't think that I knew until all this news came out about their being bankrupt that they even had an e-reader called the Kobo. And apparently they outsourced all of their online shopping to Amazon. And, you know, I actually disagree with you, Mills, that Barnes & Noble might be going out of business because they've got the Nook. Right, the Nook Color, which is doing really well, and that seems to me to be a legitimate, competitor with the Kindle.
Yeah, I just wonder how long, I don't necessarily think they're going to go out of business. I just wonder how long they can sustain their massive real estate investments in the face of, you know, ebooks and online purchasing. I mean, they may just become a smaller company, a smaller footprint company.
Right. They may just become, you know, the Burger King to Amazon's McDonald's, take that analogy again. Well, you know, sort of interesting times, and I think you know, whether you're happy to see him go or sad to see him go, it is sort of the end of an era. And you know, one thing that I think is that to keep in mind is that, you know, Borders, it started out as one of those indie bookstores in Ann Arbor. So kind of an interesting rise and fall for them. We've seen a sort of changing tracks here. A couple of developments in the wider world of computing in the last we've kind of had a haphazard recording schedule lately, but in the last couple of months, we saw the release of one and the announcement of another operating system. Apple released its latest version of Mac OS X this week. Lion, and Microsoft gave us a first preview a couple of weeks ago of Windows 8, and it's interesting. Both of these operating systems borrow an awful lot from the mobile idiom with touch interfaces and gestures and app stores and something, you know, an environment that's starting to look a lot more on the desktop, that's starting to look a lot more like the environment that people are used to on their smartphones. People have thoughts about these new operating systems? Has anybody tried Lion yet?
No. Tempted, but no.
Is the operating system as a story? Is it just dead? Is it just a piece of wallpaper that we keep in the background while we have our web browser open, when that's where all the action is going? Are these innovations something that's going to be compelling to the market and going to change the way we do our work?
I mean, I guess my take on that is that we are headed towards a place where the operating system only matters when it's a problem. In other words, when it's slowing things down, or it isn't working, or it interferes with things. But I do think that there are opportunities here, and I think both opportunities for sort of reconceptualizing the way we interact with our laptop and desktop computers. And I don't know if this will be something we want, but I can understand if I was Microsoft or Apple and looking at the success of smartphones and looking at the success of the iPad and that sort of app-based interface, we're not seeing a whole lot of growth in desktop sales, a whole lot of growth in laptop sales. We're seeing growth in smartphones and tablets. And so there's a certain business logic here. Now, the question is whether that carries on and whether it actually makes sense and whether it's effective and efficient for us to interface with our computers in this app format. But I'm not surprised to see it.
Well, there were two interesting things about the Lion release in particular for me. Number one was that it was download only. No physical media. And then probably something related, it was only $30, which that's great for an operating system upgrade from Mac in particular, you know, from Apple in particular. I mean, is that the cheapest operating system upgrade ever in the history of all operating system upgrades? I don't know. I think it might be. Apart from Linux.
Linux.
I jumped in there.
Second cheapest.
I knew where you were going with that. But yeah, I actually think that's great because I think, you know, in a way we've been on a kind of this forced upgrade type of thing. And so often it's so expensive. I've still got my first generation MacBook, my white generation MacBook, which works fine actually. And, but it's been on Tiger for quite a while. And that's, you know, that has been becoming a problem in terms of software updates and so on. So I finally bought a really cheap copy of Leopard to upgrade it to. I think Snow Leopard I bought it, but I've got to upgrade the memory first and all that kind of thing. So I'm happily behind the curve because I want it to work. I'm usually not too impressed with all the new features and certainly not impressed enough to pay a whole lot of money for them. If my first generation MacBook could handle Lion, I probably would upgrade it, but I don't think you can upgrade to Lion from Tiger. So
yeah, just a comment about Windows 8. I have to say I was surprised to see that announcement. I shouldn't have been, but I was. But I think in a campus setting, an institutional setting, there are lots of computers on college campuses that are still running XP. You know, and they're, you know, just moving towards Windows 7. So the notion that Windows 8 is coming out I think it's going to be a long time before we see the Windows 8 operating system running on lots of computers on campuses. It's just, I think, especially in this particular economic climate, IT departments have tried to stretch out hardware to last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. And when you do that, you're not running new operating systems. You're still running legacy systems. And so I think this is a, you know, we're not going to see the impact of Windows 8 on college campuses, frankly, anytime soon.
I mean, that's true in businesses, too, from what I hear. I mean, I think, you know, there's tons and tons of computers still running XP, even though everybody said Windows 7 was great. Users hate change. I hate change. Detest change. Hate it. Don't like it. And, you know, so IT departments are really unwilling to make everybody go through that unless there's a really good reason to. And I think didn't they just announce pretty recently that Windows is going to end support for XP in, I forget when, but like.
Yeah, very soon.
Anybody remember the date?
Very soon. Yeah, it's very quickly.
But they still will have been supporting it for, I don't know, something like 15 years or something like that. Right. So,
I mean, one of the interesting. Oh, sorry, Lisa, go ahead.
I mean, maybe it eases change in a bit to move to, you know, more of a sort of convergence in terms of interfaces to embrace the metaphors and the interface experience of the mobile platform, which really is gaining steam. It also seems like there are different models emerging for access to software. On the one hand, you have this app model where typically, you know, the app is inexpensive versus the cloud software as service model where the app isn't installed on your machine at all. And it's interesting to think about the significance of these two approaches.
Well, I think there's actually, it looks like, I think that's a great point, Lisa. And I actually think in Windows 8, Microsoft is actually building in a little convergence there in those two models as well. One of the interesting things about Windows 8 is it looks like the user interface and a lot of the desktop applications are actually going to be written in HTML5, JavaScript and CSS, which is kind of remarkable. I mean, you know, Microsoft has been the bastion of, C++ and Silverlight programming, and, you know, these kind of heavy desktop applications. And they're moving towards this kind of web app idiom actually on the desktop. And so I wonder if we're going to start to see something, you know, that applications that are desktop applications at once, desktop applications and web applications. So I do think there's some interesting things here. And I think that HTML5 is becoming an increasingly interesting option as it rolls out and people get more familiar with working with it, and the functionality gets better and better. HTML5 seems like something that may allow the desktop app and the web app to converge.
I don't think we're too far away from having every single laptop or desktop have a touch screen. I mean, I feel like that's coming down the road.
Well, I get Windows 8. I mean, Lion is certainly sort of touch heavy with a lot of these gestures. Windows 8, they're describing it as touch first, so that it's going to be primarily a touch interface, which I think has some implications for humanities scholarship. I mean, we deal with text, right? We don't deal with touch as well. And so it's one thing to produce mobile applications for people, you know, end users to explore the production that we create, which is mostly done with a keyboard and a mouse. It's another thing to be producing in that environment. So I think they're probably, if we move to a computing environment, which is primarily touch, even for production, it's going to, I think, have some interesting applications of the kind of work we're doing as digital humanists. I just want to tackle one thing before we sign off. We're running out of time here. I don't think we can get away without talking about the budget and debt ceiling negotiations in Washington, because I think they are going to, one way or another, however it turns out, we're recording this on the 29th of July. What was that, 4 days away or 3 days away from the doomsday deadline? However it turns out, I don't think we have an answer on that, at least not from what I heard when I last looked at the headlines. However it turns out, I think we're going to see major cuts in humanities funding through the NEH and the NHPRC, for education funding through the Department of Education, and even for fundamental scientific research through NSF. I think there's probably even going to be some cuts there. Certainly there are going to be some to NIH. Are people following this? Mills, I know you tend to follow these issues. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think, best case, the NEH and the National Endowment for the Arts are going to see a major budget cut, somewhere in the vicinity of probably, 7 to 20%. I think it's somewhere in there, and, still a moving target, because everything is a moving target as we record this podcast. But I think there's going to be significant cuts in that kind of funding. You know, the earlier version of the budget that zeroed out the NEH, I don't know about the NEA, but the zeroed out the NEH, that's failed, which is a good thing.
It failed very quickly,
because if there were no funding for the NEH, we would be possibly the only country in the world without government sponsorship of research and sort of the advancement of the humanities in anywhere. I mean, Zimbabwe has a national agency for this, and I have Zimbabwe dollars in my drawer here that they're like $10 billion Zimbabwe notes. So I guess a grant in Zimbabwe is for, hundreds of billions of dollars, but Cambodia funds it, Albania funds it, so that, lots of countries without much of a budget fund the humanities. And so I think the United States will probably continue to fund the humanities, which is good. I think it does raise a bigger strategic issue than for not only the NEH and the NEA, but all the agencies that provide funding for the kind of work that we do, whether it's the Department of Education or whomever, is the degree to which those limited funds should be spread over the same number of grants, just smaller grants, or should fewer grants at the same funding level be issued. And I think that's a conversation that we're going to have in the humanities over the next couple of years, because you know, anybody who does digital work knows that it's not inexpensive. And so there is some limit, sort of lower limit to what can be accomplished with small amounts of money. And then the other problem, of course, is that, you know, if we fund things at a lower level for a number of years, those who fund those things may say, well, look, you're doing fine with that smaller amount of money, so we'll just keep it that smaller amount.
You know, I took a tour of the Library of Congress recently. It was probably the second time I had done it. But the very lovely docent who was showing us all around the cherubs representing agriculture and industry and things like that in the Jefferson Building told us a great story about how back when the Library of Congress was finished, which I want to say was 1890-something, they came in 2 months ahead of schedule and a couple hundred thousand dollars under budget and gave back the money. And I thought, that just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, it seems to me like everybody I've ever heard who's on grant funding says we have to spend all the money or else they won't give us any more. And, you know, and that is true. That seems to be the sort of culture of it these days. But I wish it weren't. I wish we could. Surely there are cuts that can be made all across the board in United States, but I am not such a, you know, radical as to say, well, no, we can't cut a single penny. But I wish that we could cut it, you know, in a reasonable manner, not with these zeroed out ridiculous propositions, and be assured that it's not going to necessarily affect important work that we need to do when times are better.
I mean, I think what we need to fight against is this notion that was advanced by a representative who recently put forward an amendment to cut funding for the NEH by, I think, about 10%, that, you know, the NEH is a luxury good that we can't afford right now.
That's ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah, so to demonstrate that the humanities are not a luxury, that they make a vital contribution to our culture, our economic health. I mean, I think as humanists, we really need to be forceful in making that argument.
Well, and I think we can cast it. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say that I think, you know, it seems to me that the other thing, too, beyond the specific humanities things is, I mean, I think we're going to see cuts, if not across the board, nearly across the board, and the indirect impact on states, for example, especially here in Virginia and D.C. and Maryland, is going to be substantive, and we don't know quite how that's going to affect higher education. But I also think, you know, if we are, and I think we have to be realistic, there are going to be cuts in the NEH and other things that have funded humanities and digital humanities. My hope would be that we would approach these things by trying to figure out how to begin to evaluate some, you know, what projects are particularly useful and helpful and good. The problem with that, I mean, one of the problems that digital humanities has had is, one of the good things that digital humanities has had is as it's growing as a field, we've been able to sort of say, well, let's try this, well, let's try this, well, let's try this. It's not to say that we haven't, there hasn't been some selection process that the NEH hasn't run through. There's obviously that projects that get funded and that don't, but I think we're going to have to begin to look more closely about what kinds of projects do advance the goals that we think we want for the humanities in general and for digital humanities specifically. So, in some ways we might want to try to think about how we go forward with this and what are our priorities and what, you know, how do we fund those projects that seem to advance them. So,
well, and I'll tell you, my priority, especially given what we were talking about earlier with JSTOR and Swartz, is digitization, frankly, putting things up online digitally for free. And that's actually not a very sexy thing in the digital humanities these days. And as I understand it, funding organizations are getting away from funding that kind of thing.
And, yeah, almost entirely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I've always been a conservative reactionary in this regard. I actually think that that's one of the most important things you can do is provide people with free access to our culture.
Well, I think we're going to see cuts, as I think we've all said. I think there's no way around that. But I'll end it on an optimistic note. I actually think we're going to I don't think we're going to see huge cuts. I think we're going to see real cuts, but I don't think we're going to see the worst case scenarios. And the reason that is, I NEH, IMLS, NHPRC, these are organizations that mostly pour money back into the states, mostly pour money back into congressmen and congresswomen's districts. These are, at the Washington level, these are pretty lean and mean organizations. These aren't the big bureaucracies that you can point to in Washington that I think the current political climate is so against and upset with. This is a redistribution of state assets back to states that don't normally get those. So, there's a real reason for congresspeople from especially smaller and rural states to keep NEH funding in their communities. And so I don't think it's going to be hit by the Tea Party quite as hard as some other organizations. So hopefully that's true. I think maybe I'll knock on wood on that note and say goodbye to all of you. Thanks, Amanda, Mills, Lisa, and Jeff. And thanks to all of you, our listeners. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, probably in the fall, for another season of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you